Hi, I'm Mac and I'm an alcoholic.
This is crooked, but then so am I.
I want to thank Chris very much and the committee for having me here. It's been a great time. It really has. I want to thank Tammy for my spiritual experience yesterday. When you're at the top of that skyscraper, it's like, oh God, please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. We had a great time. Front row of everything. And that's how I like to live life today. In the front row, not back in the half measures row. Nothing personal, you guys back there. I know. You know, this is like five times as many people as I expected to be awake this morning. I got on the elevator with three guys stumbling in, and I said, how you doing? They didn't have name tags on, and they said, not so good. And I said, what's the matter? And they said, oh, a long, hard night, hard night. And I'm like, oh, yeah, your head hurts because you didn't use it last night, you know? And they're like, I have a knot on my head where I fell into the coffee table. And I'm looking at these guys, and I'm thinking, I'm glad that I don't feel like you feel right now. Every time I see someone with a hangover, I have this irresistible desire to torture them. This could get really nasty really quick. Oh, see, Shane and Mickey, you don't know what fun you can have up here with this thing. Maybe you do. I don't know. You are from California. I mean, you know. It is really good to be here. I look at a room full of alcoholics, and I feel the most wonderful connection today, and I just love it, you know, because like Shane and Mickey, I was not connected as a child. I didn't belong anywhere. I was pretty certain that my parents had taken home the wrong baby. I knew they did. You know, I hear a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about their dysfunctional families. Well, I come from the Beaver Cleaver family. They're not dysfunctional. I am the dysfunction in my family. They're fine. They're normal, middle-class Americans. My father was a banker. My mother was a teacher. My sister was a cheerleader. Ugh. Yeah, you know, my brother went to the Naval Academy. I mean, they're picture perfect, this bunch. And then there was me. God, you know, what happened? I can't blame my family. I'm kind of grateful now that I can't, because I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous saying, well, I'm alcoholic because this, and I'm alcoholic because my whole family's alcoholic, and all this sort of stuff. I'm alcoholic because I drank too much, too long, too often, don't process it like other people, and my thinking is a mess. It has been since I was a little tiny kid. I don't know about you guys, but I thought alcoholically long before I ever drank. I loved what Mickey was talking about, not processing information the way that it comes in. Okay? I hear things and I see things and I process them and they don't have anything to do with reality. You know, somebody was it you, Tammy, or somebody yesterday morning said they had a real problem with reality when they got here. I still have a real problem with reality. It intrudes on my fantasy on a daily basis. Okay? I don't like reality. It's just not as nice as my fantasy. You know, in my fantasy, I have several zillion dollars, legions of fans and an entourage and a limo and a castle and all this stuff, you know, and I'm 6 feet tall and I have huge, enormous, you know, things and long blonde hair and blue eyes and just about everything that I do not have in my fantasy. Okay, and I get up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I go, it's not there yet. It's not there yet. The thing is that Alcoholics Anonymous has made it all right for what is there this morning. You know, it's okay to be who I am today. I have a goal every day, and it's why I go to AA. I'm sure everyone has their own reasons for going to AA. Okay, when I first came here, my reasons for going to AA were A, my sponsor made me. B, there were some cute guys. Lots of them, as a matter of fact. And C, I didn't want to go to the bars, so I went to AA, which to me was really a gruesome alternative, you know. I got sober in Denver, Colorado. They have a club there called York Street, and York Street is open exactly the same hours that the bars are. So when I was newly sober, I went over and camped out at York Street. You know, I just stayed there because I was literally too afraid to leave the building while the bars were still open. I started drinking same time you did, Shane, when I was 12. Also smoked my first pot when I was 12. I remember the first drink because I blacked out. I don't remember the first joint. I mean, I remember smoking it, but I remember thinking, so what's the big deal? And pot never did much for me. I smoked huge quantities of it over the next 10 years. And I didn't even get horny, I got hungry. That was it. That was it. Hungry. Which is good because if you're a cocaine addict, you don't eat. Okay? So every 3 or 4 days, I would assume that I needed to eat. And I would smoke a joint and eat. And that's how I lived. When I first started drinking, I was a little kid, and I didn't have any money. So we would have to go steal our booze, either from our parents who had good booze, i.e., you know, a label like Jim Beam or something, or we would steal it from the liquor store, in which case we would steal really good booze like Mad Dog and Boone's Farm. I don't even know if they make Boone's Farm anymore. For those of you who never had Boone's Farm, terribly sorry, but you didn't miss much. I know Mad Dog is still around. I see it in the stores. Oh, God, I used to love Mad Dog. Me and my girlfriend would sneak off to the park, and we'd drink a whole bottle of Mad Dog and puke all afternoon. Just think, that was the greatest, most adult thing we could do, you know? It was wonderful, because from the time I was a little kid, I never felt like anybody liked me. As a matter of fact, I knew they didn't. I knew my family didn't even like me, that they just put up with me because they had to. It was a birth thing, and they were responsible for me, but I know they didn't like me, because they certainly did not treat me anywhere near as well as they did my siblings. I knew that, you know. They got everything, I got nothing. They were perfect, I was a screw-up, you know. Funny thing about being a Sunday morning speaker, I will try not to say fuck as much as I ordinarily would, because it's supposed to be spiritual on Sunday morning, so. But it slips out occasionally, I'm sorry about that. But I can remember from the earliest memories of drinking that after I'd had a few drinks, and that warmth spread across my belly, that all of a sudden, you looked like you liked me. I felt like you liked me. I felt cuter. I felt funnier. I felt sexier. I felt like I had more going for me. And I continued that road all the way through school. I did manage to get out of high school, but only because my mother did the work for me in correspondence classes and stuff. As a matter of fact, she still has my high school diploma because she thinks she earned it. And she's right. You know, I got a note in the mail a couple of days ago about my high school reunion, and I'm not going to tell you how many years. And they said, are you coming? And I'm thinking, I did not even go there when I was there. Why would I go there now? That makes no sense. I hated all those idiots back then. You know, these people that put on the reunion are all the cheerleaders and stuff. Because now this, I hope this doesn't insult anybody, but it might. I don't know, and I don't care. But the people in high school that put on reunions have no life, okay? They had a life in high school, because they were the popular ones, you know, they were playing football and cheerleading and all this stuff, but they grew up to be very old football players and cheerleaders who are working very dull 9-to-5 jobs with 40 million children, and I am not impressed. And then there's my life, and it's like, okay, now I have had a life, you know? And I'm really kind of proud of that. It took me a tough road to get here, but the places I've been able to go and the things that I've been able to see and the things I've been able to do since I got sober are just unbelievable. Everything I have is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. All the people in my life, without exception, my job, my home, everything is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came to you, I looked just a little tiny bit different than I do now. I weighed 92 pounds. My liver was hanging out like this, like a little pregnancy to the side. My hair was coming out in handfuls. I rode with a bicycle, well, they call them motorcycle clubs, okay? It's a nice way of saying, you know, gang of real sick fucks, okay? But they knew how to party like I did, okay? We used to sit around and do the Sig Heil thing while we're chugging, you know, Jack Daniels and eating acid and anything else we could get our hands on. I'm a human garbage disposal. I don't introduce myself as an alcoholic addict because I think it's a little redundant, all right? Besides, I only have an hour, and if I list all my addictions, it's gone, so we're not going to do that. But these people would eat anything, and I never cared what it was I was taking. I don't know about you guys. I think Mickey was talking about this the other night. I never cared to research exactly what it was I was putting in my mouth. Okay, I did own a PDR, Physician's Desk Reference, and I would eat the pill and then go home and look it up so that I would know whether I was to expect to go up, down, or sideways. You know, give it to Max, she'll eat anything, and I would. I would. I think they would give it to me to see if I would go up, down, or sideways before they would take it. I was just a human garbage disposal. If it altered my perception of reality, I wanted it. The problem I have is that anything that does that for me, I want a little more, and a little more, and a little more, and then I run into my level problems. I know you've all had this level problems. We're all looking for the level. the perfect high. We had it maybe once, you know, when we were 13 or something. The perfect high. And if I do just the right amount of cocaine and just the right amount of tequila, I'll be there. Okay? The problem is, it takes, what, 5 minutes for the tequila to kick in? By then, I've already done 3 lines. So then I shoot by the line, and I'm up here like this, so I start drinking tequila so I can settle down a little bit, and then I'm settled way down, you know, and I have to do some more coke to get, and I was like this the whole time, you know, I could never find the middle. And I got to the point at the end of my drinking where every day it took a quarter better of vodka and 5 or 6 grams of coke just to maintain, just to sustain daily living. And for those of you that have ever done cocaine, and I'm sure there's maybe one or two people in here who did, it's an expensive habit, and I had to do things that I would not do to get it. Okay? I always used to laugh when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they used to throw me in the hooker tank when I got busted for drunk and disorderly. They didn't have a separate drunk tank, so they would put me in with these women. And I would sit in there with this attitude, how dare you put me in here with these whores. Okay, these prostitutes. Now, I've got puke in my hair, puke on my clothes, probably some tequila or something else spilled on me, my underwear on backwards, and I have an attitude about these women. Because, you see, I never sold my body for money. However, if you had a gram of cocaine or a bottle of tequila, I'm yours. I'm yours. I sold my body for any and everything that I needed to feel better. My body was a tool to be used to get what I wanted. I had no self-respect. I had no self-esteem. I had no morals. I had no values. Simply do what you have to do to get what you need. And it's a hell of a way to live, because when you go home after 3 days of this crap and you wake up the next morning and you can't even hold down a spoonful of Jell-O, I can remember trying to eat a spoonful of Jell-O and puking it up. That was when I had pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. It was not when I was drunk. I don't know about you guys, but I never tried to kill myself drunk. Over a dozen times sober, okay? Never drunk. When I'm drunk, I'm not even there. I don't know I'm miserable. You know, I identify with Mickey. I used to go get on planes drunk. We'd go to the airport to watch people, because I like to do that. And we'd drink, and we'd drink, and the next thing you know, I'm walking down a plane concourse that does not look familiar. Well, I'm not going to ask somebody where I am. That's tacky. Excuse me, what city am I in? So I would look for a newspaper rack, and it would say Atlanta Journal or whatever, Atlanta Constitution. I would think, okay, we're in Atlanta. Now we have to get home, because I had this problem with blackouts. How many people in here are blackout drinkers? Cool. So you'll understand. The first one I had was really interesting. I was sitting in a bar, and I was working in this bar. You have to work in a bar if you're drunk. Eventually, because that's your supply line. And they had live music, and I looked at my watch, and it said 8:30 or something, and I'm listening, you know. And I looked at my watch, and it said 11:45. It seemed like only a few minutes, you know, and I was like, that's kind of weird, you know. So I asked somebody, what time is it? 11:45. Oh. Wow. I don't think I'll drink tequila anymore. I'm going to vodka. And that's alcoholic thinking. And the blackouts went from that 3 hours to a lot more hours to a lot more days. And I didn't mind blackouts. I really didn't. The only bad part of blackouts is, have you ever noticed how people that do not drink like we drink, they have this desire to let you know the next day everything that you did? Why do they do that? You know, if I wanted to know, God would not have given me a blackout, all right? I believe God is giving me a blackout to protect me from my own behavior. I really do. But you've always got some gink, all right, who comes up to you the next day and says, do you know what you did last night? And I'm like, no, but I'm pretty sure you're going to tell me, aren't you? You know? And I did some interesting things in blackouts. Really interesting things in blackouts. That's how my underwear got on backwards. And that was when my underwear was still on, which was the first, you know, when you get out of bed after blackout, the first thing, if you're a woman especially, you check the clothes, all right? Do I have my clothes? Are they on frontwards? Am I in my own bed or someone else's? And you roll over and you look and you're like, oh, my God. You've heard of the coyote love affair, you know? Chew your arm off before you awake this creature up, you know, to get out of bed and get away. And as a matter of fact, one time I came out of a blackout in a clinch, you know, with some guy on the couch. To this day, I have no idea who this person was. But we're going at it hot and heavy on the couch in his living room, and I come out of a blackout. Yeah, imagine if you're this poor sucker, right? Gone to a bar to pick up some broad, gets one, comes home, going at it, and she flies back and says, "Who the hell are you and what am I doing here?" He's like, I said, "Get me out of here. Take me back to my car." And he couldn't get me out of there fast enough. To this day, I do not know who he was, where I was, you know, what I was doing. I kind of like to hope that someday in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, some guy will be sitting there going, "Holy shit, it was her." It could happen, you know. Just things like that do happen. I love it. But that's kind of what my life was like when I was ready to come here, only I didn't know I was ready to come here. I had been in the nut house several times because my parents were aware something was a little off, you know, just a little. And they being good parents and loving parents, they wanted to do something to help me. So they sent me to this shrink guy, you know, and I went in there and I lied to him. You don't tell shrinks the truth, whatever you do, because they'll gas you or something. And I lied to the guy and he put me in the nut house that day. Which is kind of scary. I wonder what he'd have done to me if I'd have told him the truth. I'd probably still be locked up, you know. Permanent lockup, but they put me in the nut house. And, you know, the nut house was the first place in my life that I ever really felt like I belonged. I loved it. They give you Dalmain. They give you Quaaludes. They give you lots of love and attention. You sit there in group and they agree that it's your mother's problem. They agree that your father did this to you. They hug you all the time, tell you how neat you are, and you get to build all sorts of little clay things, you know, ashtrays and stuff. And it's cool. I really liked the nut house. I seriously liked the nut. I liked the nut house so much, when they would try and discharge me, I would do something dramatic, like slash my wrist or something, so that I could stay in the nut house. I don't want to do reality. Don't make me go out there and do life. I can't. I just can't. I cannot go out there with those people and do that thing. I'm not capable. Okay, I'm absolutely incapable of doing life. I can't work. I don't want to work. I don't want to be around those people that are so-called normal. I just leave me in here with the nuts. You know, we had one lady play tennis in the hallway. No net, no ball, no racket, but she's out there playing and we're ducking, right? I loved it. I didn't want to leave. And after about 3 months, they checked me out of there, and I lasted about 3 more months, and I got them to check me back in. Because I wanted to stay there. It was a safe place for me. They gave you a bed, you know, they fed you 3 times a day, and you got to do all this neat stuff. Thorazine is a real hoot. For those of you that haven't had Thorazine, it's like a giant mixture of all the best downers you ever took. It just slaps you right into... Great drug. And I took Thorazine for a long time, trying to get antipsychotic. I like that. But I went in there again, and then I came out, and then I went back. I didn't want to not be in the nut house. But nut houses won't keep you forever, especially when your insurance is getting a little thin. And I had to be set out free again. And I was in college at the time, and we were talking about this morning. I was president of our Friday afternoon club. You had to do this enormous double bong to even join, you know. And it was in my dorm room every Friday afternoon, and the whole point of this exercise was to get as many passed out bodies in the hallway as possible. And there were, you had to step over them after our Friday afternoon club meetings. College was great. I didn't learn anything. Yeah, I did. Take that back. Learned how to make trash can punch, you know, where everybody comes and dumps in whatever, and then you fill it with punch, and you drink it. Everclear, I don't even know if they still let you buy that stuff anymore, but Everclear is a wonderful thing because it makes everything that tastes good work. All right. Most alcohol tastes terrible to me. I don't like the taste of booze. I really don't. I know that some alcoholics did and some alcoholics don't. I'm one that didn't. I just detested the taste of booze. That's why I drank tequila, because you shoot her, right? Just get it past your taste buds as quickly as possible. And vodka doesn't taste but that Everclear. Boy, dump that in a bucket of Duffy's Punch and you're in there, you know. You're in there. And the thing about that is it works perfectly for someone like me, because being an experienced drinker, I kind of like the surprise of when it would hit me. You could drink a whole gallon of that stuff and not feel anything, and a half an hour later you are face down with your underwear on backwards. Same shit, different day, you know. I was in college and I was trying to fit in there and didn't, except with the party crowd, and I decided college wasn't going to work for me. Just wasn't a real healthy place for me to be. I don't remember thinking that. It's just I quit, you know. And I went to work in a bar. Great bar. Boy, this bar was great. It was 2 stories, had 3 bands, 9 bars, which is perfect if you're me, because if they cut you off at one, you just, the next one, you can get really loaded and 9 bars cut you off, you know. And I was in there, and I was, it was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That was my life. How much could I snort? How much could I drink? How often could I get laid? And would I live through it? That was it. And I remember thinking at that time that life, as I knew it, stinks. It's a big, dark, black, ugly, nasty hole, and I don't want to be here anymore, and I want to check out. And so I'd do the old slash the wrist or take the pills or jump in front of trucks or any of the other things. I didn't really want to die, obviously, or I'd have bought a gun and blown my head off. But it was the drama thing more than anything, I think. You know, it's very dramatic. I slashed my wrist once and I went to the hospital. And I'm bleeding. It's a mess. I could see bone and everything. And I went in there and the lady goes, here, fill out this form. And I said, well, I kind of need to see a doctor right now. And she goes, well, all these other people are waiting and you'll have to wait too. And I took my wrist and went plop, right on her desk over her papers and blood and shit flying everywhere. It was so dramatic. And she's like, ooh, 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 ooh. And she rushed me right in there. And that's, you know, as long as you do what I want you to do immediately, we're going to get along just fine. Just fine, you know. I called my parents one night after another blackout and another problem. I'd been ripped off in a drug deal, which is, of course, how you have to, that's what you have to do to get as much coke as you want to do. You have to deal with it. That's the only way. And I got ripped off, and I was upset, and I was angry, and I threw a shot glass at the wall in the bar, and it shattered, and my boss said, why don't you take the rest of the night off? And I'm sure he was thinking, why don't you take the rest of my life off? But I called my parents yet again at 2:30 in the morning and said, I need help. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, which is so bizarre because these words did not occur in my vocabulary before I called that night. You got to understand, this is pre-Betty Ford, pre-care unit, pre-all that crap. There was no Alcoholics Anonymous stuff on TV, none of that. The word alcoholic, if I ever used it, which I don't think I did, just specifically meant those bums downtown that you used to go out and tease and throw money at to watch them beat each other up and stuff, you know, cheap entertainment. And I told my dad I thought I was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he said, okay, and we'll get you some help. And they called the same shrink, and he said, we're going to put you in Mount Airy Psychiatric Center. Far out, a nut house. I mean, I can do this. This was the goal, the nut house. So they came and got me, and I remember kind of walking down the hall in the nut house, check in, you got to check in. And I sat down, and the first thing this nurse asked me is, what have you ingested today in the way of alcohol and drugs? And I was like, it's a very strange question in the nut house. So I told her, I says, why don't you make a list of every available drug, and I'll just cross off the one or two that I haven't taken today. It'll be quicker. Because I had done, it was one of those nights where you're just everything, you know, some magic mushrooms, some cocaine, some pot, some coilers, a lot of booze, just any, you know, blah, blah, everything, give it to me. And she wanted a list, and I didn't understand her question. And then she took me into my room and said, this is going to be your room. And I said, well, aren't you going to give me like a sleeping pill or something? I knew the drill in nut house. And she says, no, you will not be getting any drugs in here. At that point, I tried to run. They nailed me before I ever got to the door. I had been tricked. He put me in an alcohol treatment unit. Now, I did not know this until a week later. Because I went into bed, and I had convulsions and all sorts of fun stuff, you know, and shaking and sweating and sweating and shaking and puking and shitting and sweating and shaking and puking and shitting for 4 days. You just sit on a toilet with a blanket around you and a wastebasket in front of you because you cannot get up and down fast enough. You don't know whether to sit on it or kneel in front of it. You cannot move that quickly, so you just sit with a trash can in front of you, you know. And after about 4 days of that, I went back to bed, and someone took the covers down, and I took them back up, and she took it back down, and I looked up, and here was this face, right? It's like, oh, you know, don't do that to me. I said, what the do you want? She said, you're going to get out of bed. I said, I don't want to get out of bed. She said, I don't recall asking if you wanted to get out of bed. Get your ass up. Well, now, I'm a fighter, I'm a biker, so I fly out of bed and I'm ready, right? All 92 pounds of me, boy, I'm going to let her have it. And she said, cut the tough shit, honey. It isn't going to work in here. Put on your little paper slippers and let's go. So I put on my backward gown and my forward gown and my little paper slippers, and I followed her, and we went down the basement of this building. We went in this room, and there was all these people that looked like you. And I walked in there, and I'm like, oh, you know what? This is different. And so I sat down, and some yo-yo at the top of the room said, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, oh, sure you are, dude, you know. And that's all I remember for a while. And then I do remember them passing the basket. And I'm thinking, yeah, I haven't got any money. I don't have any pockets. Ha, ha, ha. And then they said something about a big book, and that's when it clicked. I'd seen those guys in the airport, hadn't you, with big books? Take the bald guys with sarongs. Take this book, give me a dollar. So I was like, it's a scam. It's a cult, man. They're going to, you know, they're going to make me go to the airport, shave my head, and do the big book thing, you know, give the book thing. I know I'm onto them, you know. And so as I'm leaving the room, I'm like, talk to you, because I'm sorry to keep using that word, but those are the only two words I knew when I came here. And I'm leaving the room, and they said, keep coming back. And I said, fuck you. And they said, keep coming back. Now, this is really a different reaction than I'm used to. I'm used to, get out of here, don't ever come back. And they said, keep coming back, even after I said, fuck you. So I said it again. And they said it again. And I walked with the same lady back upstairs, and I said, that is the weirdest bunch of people I have ever seen in my life. And she said, I imagined you entertained them too. A couple of days later, she came up, and she made me go back. I did not hear a thing. I really don't remember hearing anything in my first UAA meeting. I zeroed in on the book thing. I zeroed in on the basket thing. I zeroed in on them stupid smiles these people had. I did not hear a thing. And I started to get into the treatment thing. You know, we got to watch Father Martin. He's cool. Eat graham crackers. Group therapy, which I was very good at. And I was hanging in treatment, digging it, you know, and this lady, her name was Charlie, and it was very bizarre, Charlie, because she had blonde hair, green eyes, a boy's nickname, and she'd ridden with a motorcycle gang. Happened to be a rival gang of the one I rode with. And I got to talking to her, and she was like this really happy person. It was bizarre. I was not used to being around happy people. And she just smiled. I can remember, when I think about Charlie, I remember that stupid smile on her face. I don't think I ever saw her not smile. It was revolting, okay? And she started talking to me about perhaps it would interest me to read this book. And so she dug out this big old nasty blue stained book with writing all in it and said, here, start reading this. I was telling Mickey before the meeting, I couldn't. You know, I have this huge IQ, a 3.7 grade average in college. Now here's a book that's written in third grade language, okay? I'm reading a sentence. I'm like, what is wrong with me? I could not read a paragraph and retain it over and over and over. And I finally, she said, never mind, just go to the back. So I went to the back, and there were some cool stories in there, including one which is not in our present edition called The Blonde Bombshell. And it's about this woman who drags balls off bar stools, kicks cops, and so forth. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay, I identified with her. And I didn't realize at the time that identifying was the point. Because I am really sick. You guys got to understand, when I came here, there were no connections going on up here at all. I'd fried them. Crosswires, and I had trouble some days remembering my name, and I had trouble some days remembering which way to put on my little paper slippers. And I had trouble some days just remembering why it was that I was where I was. And they still let you out after 21 days, so I went traipsing off all treatment-centered, you know, grouped and fixed and patched up and better. And I went and got my very own apartment with somebody else's money, which was my MO. And I sat there, and Charlie would call and say, you're going to go to a meeting? Well, no, I'm busy. Okay, so she'd call and say, you're going to go to a meeting? No, I'm busy. She says, I'll come get you. I say, I won't be here. She says, I'll come get you, and I would leave. I wouldn't be there. And this went on for about 3 months. I think I went to one meeting. Maybe. I don't remember. And after about 3 months, I had this little person. Actually, there are several people that live in my head. Lots of them, but I have one that's very loud and very obnoxious, and this little person starts whispering, you're not really alcoholic. First of all, you're too young. Secondly, you're a woman. Thirdly, you have a watch and a car. You're just simply, I mean, you don't meet the criteria of alcoholic. You just partied a tiny bit too hard with the wrong people, stop taking cocaine, and just, you know, have two drinks like normal people. So I set it up with a couple of friends of mine. We were going to go out and just have two drinks like normal people. And I went to this bar in Evergreen. I didn't realize you'd ever been there, but I went in there with $4 to have two drinks, and I was going to have two drinks and go home like a normal person. And it was a really good plan, except I blacked out on the first drink. I went to the bar and ordered a double kamikaze. Fired it up, and that was it. Next thing I remember, I wake up the next morning, and it's all over again. I got puke in my hair. I'm checking for my underwear. The inside of me feels like a hole this big. They had told me this was progressive in treatment. They had told me this would get worse whether I drank or not. Now, this makes no sense to the logical mind. Think about it. How can something get worse you're not doing? Okay? But I had never blacked out on the first drink before. And I crawled down the hall to my friend's house, and I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. It was the saddest moment in my life. The day I realized, deep down all the way in my gut, that I was alcoholic. It's like Shane was saying last night, my life is over. Okay, the party's over. I got to go sit in the rooms with all them old farts who say brilliant things like, honey, I spilled more booze than you ever drank. I did hear a good comeback for that. Next time someone says that to you, just smile very sweetly and say, dear, if you'd have spilled less and drank more, you might have got here a little sooner. It works. I crawled back to AA and Charlie, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and I began to try and read the book. I got an assimilation problem. I'm retarded or something. And I can't seem to understand what numbers mean or anything else, and so I'm looking at these steps, and it says, step one, admitted you're powerless over alcohol. Okay, no problem. Your life is unmanageable, most obviously. Okay. Step two, yes, I know I'm insane. Power greater than myself. They're talking about God, and I'm not doing that. So I went to step three, well, has the God thing. No, so we're not doing that. Step four, because God did this to me, after all. I mean, didn't he do it to you? He gave other people nice things, and he shit on me. And that's how I looked at God, okay? Poo on him. I don't want anything to do with God. God did this to me. I'm being punished. I'm a bad person. Don't even talk to me about God. I'm not interested in hearing this God crap. So then we go to step four. Well, a moral inventory, please. I have no morals, so I don't have to do that. Five. Tell the other person your moral inventory. Not necessary if you don't do four. Six. Shortcomings. Don't have any. Seven. Don't have to worry about it. Eight. Made a list of amends. Oh, I could definitely do some amends. So I set about to do step nine. Like 2 weeks sober. Okay? And I do. I go out there, and I had a similar situation to what happened to Shane. I went to a lady's house, and I knocked on the door, and she opened it, and I said, hi, I'm Mac, and I'm an alcoholic, and I have to make amends, and I slept with your husband last spring while you were out of town, and she hit me really hard, and really hard, and continued to hit me, and I finally got away from her, and I went crawling to Charlie, and I'm crying. I'm like, God, I tried to do the right thing. Make me amends. And Charlie's laughing. I'm like, why are you laughing? And she's like, you're such an asshole. She said, the steps have numbers in front of them. One comes before two, comes before three, comes before four. They are in order for a reason. People with greater minds than yours figured this all out a long time ago, and maybe, just maybe, you should try them in order. What a concept. In order. So I started over. One, no problem. Two, I told her, I said, Charlie, I can't do this God thing. I can't do this God thing. Every time I even think of God, I get sick. Every time someone mentioned it in a meeting, I left. I don't want to hear about God. Okay? Do not talk to me about God. And Charlie, in her loving way, would say, you're such an asshole. You know, I love the terminology today. You hear people come in and they talk about dysfunction and inner child and issues. And when I got sober, it was like, you're a drunken asshole. You know, you need to do something about that. And they didn't care if you had issues, you know, or an inner child. Who gives a crap? You're an asshole. And she used to say things like that to me all the time. You're an asshole. And I'm like, why do you call me that? And she said, because you are. And I would say, I don't want to do this. And she'd say, I didn't ask you if you wanted to do this, you know. And she knew how to manipulate me because she was like me. She would say things to me like, whatever you do, do not write down anything for step four. Do not take a pencil to paper. You are not ready. It's going to be months before you're ready to do the fourth step. Well, you know, if you're anything like me, I have to do it now, okay? Because you don't tell me not to do something. So I start writing. And she's like, good. And she read it. And she said, this is garbage. Ripped it up and threw it away. Ooh, now you've pissed me off, okay? She says, I suggest that you look in the book where it has a little chart with Mrs. Brown and Mr. Green and all these people, and you try and do the fourth step just that way. Well, I don't know how to do anything just that way. So she drew the little columns for me, and she said, write down the person you have the biggest resentment towards, the biggest resentment in the world. And I couldn't come up with it. because there were so many. She said, who do you have more resentment against on this planet than anybody else? And I said, me. She said, write it down. Okay, so I wrote, Mac. She said, why do you resent Mac? Oh, well, the list is endless. I'm a piece of shit. I'm a slut. I'm a drunk. I ruined my family. My father won't talk to me. I've screwed up every relationship I've ever done. The list is endless. And I'm writing all this stuff down. She goes, okay. She goes, now what does this affect? And I wrote it down and everything. And she said, are you ever going to be able to forgive yourself? And I says, I don't think so. She said, that's okay because God will. So I says what every alcoholic says. I says, oh yeah? Prove it. Show me. Kind of like a burning bush something, you know? I want like tablets and stones. And it's got to be done in front of my face. Not that I doubt or anything. And we went through this process inch by inch by inch, and Charlie, God bless her, she was patient with me, and she manipulated the hell out of me, and she was mean, but she stuck with me, and I wanted what she had. And that was the first time in my life I recall wanting what any other woman had, unless it was her husband, of course, in which case I just took it. But after about, I don't know, about 8 or 9 months, I started getting well. You know how we get all these brilliant stuff going on in our head. We got good ideas. You know, we're about fixing to get in a relationship. You know, I love that when people say, don't get in a relationship the first year. That is really, I want you guys to know what a good idea that is. Really a good idea. I have no idea whether or not it works. No one's ever done it. But it's a good idea. Really good. And so I'm getting in a relationship, and I'm thinking, getting all these good ideas, and I decide I'm going to go to Vegas and be a dealer, legal kind of card. So I'm going to run off to Vegas and be a dealer. And so I do. You know, when you're 10 months years old and ready to go, you go. Okay? So I go running off to Las Vegas. I'm going to be a dealer. Yeah. And I end up in Las Vegas, and I don't know anyone. And I don't know what to do, and I don't know where to go, and I go to Alcoholics Anonymous just to be around people. God is very sneaky, you guys. You may think you can get out of going to meetings. God will find a way to get you to meetings. I like to think that if alcohol does not bring you to your knees, Alcoholics Anonymous will. Okay? God will get you to meetings. It might not be right now. It might not be in the near future. Sooner or later, you're going to get to meetings or you're going to croak. It's that simple. And God moved me to Las Vegas, so I would go to meetings. And I started going to meetings every day just to be around people. I can't stand to be alone. You know, you don't sit in a room with the person you hate the most. You just don't. So I go around people. And in Las Vegas, they're very wonderful, wonderful sobriety, but they're not real warm at first because there's a lot of people on the scam in Vegas. There's a lot of people who aren't what they say they are, and they're cautious at first when you go out there. And so they were kind of watching me, and I was kind of watching them, and I trying to do the steps, and I asked this lady to sponsor me, and I kind of lost touch with Charlie, and I started doing really well. I got a job dealing in a little toilet on the strip called the Slots of Fun, and making $14 a day in totes, but I didn't have to work downtown. Cops an attitude about that, but I went back to Denver to show everyone, you know, here I was sober, I'm working in a casino, life is good, I'm pretty cool, and I went to a meeting telling how cool I was, and someone there had asked me if I'd been at Charlie's funeral, and I said, Charlie who? And they said, you didn't know, and I said, I don't want to hear any more of this. And it turned out that after 7 years of sobriety, Charlie drank, okay? Beautiful, smiling Charlie drank. She lasted 1 week and blew her head off. Her boyfriend came home from 7-Eleven and found her brains all over the bedroom wall. And I'll tell you what, kids, that's where it happens, okay? There will come a time in your sobriety where you reach the fork in the road. You're going to go or you're going to stay. You're going to stay sober or you're going to drink. It's right there. When your guts are churning, your heart hurts, and the pain is so great that you can't stand it anymore, and that's when you're going to make the decision. Okay? It's either life or death. Because I learned from Charlie, we die if we drink. Okay? Before it would have been you. Haven't you ever wanted to be the one who selects who dies from this disease? I've often thought we should have like a panel. Who selects who gets to croak from this disease? All the old nasty farts, they go first. All the old nasty farts who sit in clubhouses day in and day out playing pinochle, they go first. Gurus get them all, you know. I don't get to pick. And I realized at that moment in my life that alcoholism could and would kill me if I drank again. And I realized at that point in my life that you had been telling me for 2.5 years I needed a God of my understanding, and I damn well better find him. damn well better find them. So I went on the great search, okay? I started looking for spirituality in everything, and I found it in some wonderful places. Now, I'm going to talk a little about my God, and I hope that nobody takes offense because it's not very conventional, but it's as I understand him. You don't have to use him. He's available if you need him, but you don't have to use him. I saw this movie called Oh God, okay, with George Burns. He said some really cool stuff, some cosmic stuff, like God doesn't come down and fix things for you. He gives you the tools to do it yourself. Cool. And there were some other things in there, and I decided that George Burns would be a good way for God to look. He's cute, and he's cuddly, and like a grandpa. So my higher power looks like George Burns. Which is all right with me. May not be with you, but it is with me. Then I saw the movie Star Wars, and they talked about the Force, which is the energy from every living thing. Oh, okay, stick that in there. Okay, we have a lot of Native Americans in Las Vegas, and I started listening to them talk about the Great Spirit, Mother Earth, Father Sky. Stick that in the bag. Okay, and pretty soon, I found that when I was saying, please keep me sober in the morning, and thank you, God, at night, I had something that I could come to grips with, I could picture, okay? When I would get in a panicky situation where I'd be afraid, I could turn around and see George sitting there and not be afraid, okay? When I was lonely and I was frightened and I was in pain, I could imagine George giving me a hug. You can't imagine the first time this guy came into work, who does George Burns impersonation, looks just like him, right? He comes into work and I'm like, God! And he's looking at me going, what? And I'm like, nothing, you wouldn't understand. Go about your business, you know, but it was like, cool, you know? And I started seeing God and hearing God in the most unusual places, okay? And this, I believe, is what the spiritual search has been for me. God is always there. He's always been there, always will be there. We don't have a choice about that, all right? The only choice I have is, do I look for him? Do I listen for him, or do I ignore him? He's there. It doesn't matter, okay? I really feel God is not our choice, okay? God's already there. What do I do to feel his presence? How do I look for the miracle? Okay? Some of my ways are a little unusual. I don't know about you guys. You'll be driving down the freeway and you're worrying about one of your sponsees. Is it driving you nuts? You want to kill them, shoot them, beat them, strangle them, and throw them off a cliff? And a song will come on, Kathy Mattea, Letting Go. Oh. Okay? I believe that God can do things like that. I believe that God puts you where you need to be when you need to be there. I was a couple years sober and I was traveling with this big musical show, you know. We're all over the world. It was great. 120 kids. I'm the only alcoholic. There's another kid in there who's Al-Anon. And I won't badmouth Al-Anons because I love them dearly. Our ladies of perpetual suffering, where would we be without them? But actually, I'm married to another alcoholic. My sponsor told me to go to Al-Anon and I'm like, I'm not ready to do that yet. But I found an Al-Anon book in his drawer, and I freaked out. I'm like, why do you need Al-Anon to live with me? I was so hurt, you know? And then it's like, I thought about it, and it's like, oh, man, I'm surprised he didn't go, you know, from day one. But well, I'm over there traveling around Europe, and I'm living in people's houses, because that's what you do in this particular group. They stick you in a house, and it's totally random. Nobody asks for anybody. You just get stuck in a house, and I hadn't been to a meeting in about a month because you're not allowed to ask for transportation anywhere. You go where the family's going, you do what the cast is doing. You don't ask, you fit in. Okay, and I hadn't been into a meeting in a month, which for me, very long time. And I was feeling sick physically, and I was really starting to second guess, you know, whether I should even stay there. It was the experience of a lifetime, but not if I drank kind of thing, and I might need to go home. And we ended up in Zurich, Switzerland, and I ended up in this lady's house, and she spoke English, thank God, you know, because I just didn't want to do German. Right then, I was in a bad mood. You know how you are after having had a meeting for a month? You're free, you know, and this kid in Al-Anon just happened to be placed with a friend of hers, and we all went over there for dinner, and they had this cheese fondue that was swimming in wine. I mean, I was miserable. Self-pity. Unhappy. Poor, poor, poor me. You know, and he said something to me to try and cheer me up, and I said something about a tenth step, and this lady's head snapped up, and she goes, oh, do you know the program? I said, yeah, I've been sober about 3.5 years, and I know the program. And she goes, oh, that's lovely, darling. You know, my husband, I've been sober 16 years. You know, I started Al-Anon here in Switzerland. I know where all the English-speaking AA meetings are. I'll take care of you, dear. You're all right here now. There are 1 million people in Switzerland. There's 125 kids in my cast. You may choose to believe that it's coincidental I was placed with that woman. I do not. I got one of your gratitude attacks and goosebumps. Vroom, vroom. Tears, you know. Shut. Okay? That's God. That's a God shot. Okay? Stuff like that happens to me all the time. Does stuff like that happen to you guys? If it doesn't, you're not looking hard enough. Okay? You've got to look for the miracles in your life. They are not going to come up and kick you in the ass. You know, I used to be one of these people. I love to sit on the couch, eat Twinkies, and pray to be skinny. It's unlikely that I will just be skinny. I'm going to have to work at being skinny, and as you can tell, I have not chosen to done that yet. Okay? I used to lay in bed. I had a pretty good singing voice, and I used to pray for God to make me famous. Someone would just knock on my door, say, "Hey, I heard you could sing. Here's a contract for $40 trillion. It has not happened. Okay? This thing with relationships. I just love relationships. Don't you love relationships? Aren't they fun? You want to get screwed up, get yourself in a relationship. Every character defect you have is going to come out. Every high, every low. I mean, you're going to be all over. But relationships are great. If you want to see how sick you really are, just run right out and grab someone of the opposite sex, same sex, whatever you're into, and get into a relationship. Okay? And see, I had this problem with relationships. I would go out there and I would grab these guys that were my type. Okay? You know your type? Somebody laughed. They're like, they know their type. He was Italian. He wore a three-piece Armani suits. He had a diamond pinky ring and a Corvette. And an attitude. You're real asshole. Okay? And I would just fall in love instantly with this guy, and about a week later, we would start talking. And we did not like each other. We did not think alike, and it would be over. And I dated this guy like for 20 years. His name changed. His size changed, his face didn't change, his thing guy, 20 years, over and 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 over, and it was like really getting old. And finally I just said, that's it. God wants me to be single. So I will be single. And God was up there going, cool. What I've been waiting for. Got a little treat for you. About 9 months later, I went to this conference that you guys are coming up on, Mid-South Regional in 1989. Great conference, by the way. Super duper. And there was this guy there. He was an Okie. He had blue jeans and boots and a truck. And he said things like, "I mean, and do what? And six and two." And it was him. An Okie. And I got home to Las Vegas and I said, "God, what are you doing?" Not only is he an Okie, he's in Oklahoma. And God, in his wisdom, is thinking, yes, you'll have to talk. What a concept. Talk first. Talk first. We had to talk first. I've never done that. How many people of you have ever done that? Talk first. Not even one. Okay? And we talked for hours and hours and hours and hours. And to make a long story short, he moved to Las Vegas in 1990. We'll be married 5 years in October. Me and my Okie. And it has not been easy. All right? It has not been easy. But my husband and I believe that God chose each other. I mean, God put us together. There's just a series of circumstances that happened that weekend. It couldn't have been anything else. He wasn't supposed to be there. You know, he wasn't supposed to take me. I mean, there's a lot of, he wasn't supposed to, and I wasn't supposed to, but we did and got together. And it's been very difficult. You have two controlling alcoholics in one household, all right? I swore I would never get married. I figured, you know, I really love men, but they live like bears with furniture, and I don't want one in my house. Because I'm kind of a fanatic, you know, about my house. And I want everything. I know this will be very, very strange to you guys, but I want everything my way. And so now I have someone else in there who thinks that everything should be his way, and sometimes there's some friction. You know, sometimes there's some friction. But he has a program, and I have a program. We have a God of our understanding. His may be different than mine. Okay? We made a deal the day we moved in together. Your program is your program. My program is my program. All right? I don't tell him, you need to call your sponsor. You need to go to a meeting. That's none of my business. He doesn't tell me, you need to call your sponsor. You need to go to a meeting. Of course, he knows better. I'm sober twice as long. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Am I done? Okay. I just know in my heart that this is the right place for us to be. Okay? And we struggle through our daily life. We do the best we can, and when it gets crappy and it gets uncomfortable, then we have to take a look at ourselves. Okay? I don't look at Michael when I hurt today. It's not his responsibility to make me happy. He was not put on this earth, contrary to my original belief, to make me happy. Okay? The only person on this earth that is supposed to make me happy is right here in my skin. And if I'm unhappy, it's because I'm not doing something I'm supposed to be doing to make myself happy. Okay? How many of you guys got to go to International? Cool. I hope you all get to go to Minneapolis. You really have not been high until you have said the Lord's Prayer with 63,000 people. I thought that 3,000 was a kicker. And when we were in that stadium doing that, it was like, boom, you know, the energy was great. And I was there with my husband, and we fought the whole first day of that conference. And of course I get real, you know, snotty. I know you don't believe this, but and I say things like, this is not acceptable. You will not talk to me like that. I don't deserve it, and you will not do it. And he's looking at me like, fuck you. So then I'm looking at him like, fuck you. Next thing you know, good healthy fighting, right? Good healthy fighting. But I know that God wants me to work this out. So I put it together and I get myself by myself and I say, Mark, where are you wrong here? You're a controlling bitch. Back off. Learn to manipulate. No, you gotta be sneakier, okay? You gotta be sneakier. No, this marriage thing is hard work, you guys. I don't care how long you're sober. Relationships are hard work. But today I don't just bail. You know, like everything in my life I started and didn't finish. I don't do that today. When I start something, I'm in there for the duration. I'd be leaving completing things today. When I said I would stay with this guy till we died, that means A, we stay together till we old and we die, or B, I shoot him. Okay? So shooting him is not an option. I guess we're going to get old. That's my plan, you know. I believe it's God's plan. I think you have to look for the miracles in your life. I think you have to listen for the miracles in your life. Most of the things that I have heard that were profoundly affecting me, I heard out of the mouth of other alcoholics. Okay? I did not hear them when I was home by myself watching TV. Although that has happened to me too. I was watching Cagney and Lacey once. And I was in a bad space. Are you ever in a bad space? I must have had a lot of dysfunctional issues going on with my inner child. Okay? And I was pissed. And I'm sitting there and I turn on the TV and Cagney and Lacey come on. And you know, I don't forget which one's Cagney and which one's Lacey, but the one that was a drunk, okay, is sitting there talking to a nun. She's in the program and everything. They show all this on TV. And she says to this nun, I, you know, I've had it with God. He shits on me all the time. I don't like this program. I don't like not drinking. I've had it, you know. And this nun looks her in the eye and says, you must be very far away from him to be so angry. And it was like, I must be very far away from him to be so angry. My spiritual condition is my business, okay? I have to work on that on a daily basis. I have to stay connected to my higher power. It's my responsibility to stay spiritually connected. You're not going to do that for me. You can give me the rush. You know, I can get the God rush here with the goosebumps and everything. Every time a little miracle happens, I can get that. But I have to stay close to my higher power. I have to do it through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care who says it's a suggestion. It's a rule. Okay. I also get a little tired of people in AA meetings who say, I didn't do anything. This is all a gift from God. Bullshit. Okay. This deal requires your active participation. You must not pick up a drink in order to stay sober. That's a rule. God is not going to come down and slap it out of your hand. okay? Once your active participation begins in Alcoholics Anonymous, once you make the decision, like Shane was talking about last night, that you want what we have, and you're willing to do it our way rather than yours, which is, you know, works so well, then you may have a shot at staying sober and being happy and productive. I've had a terrible 3 years. All right. I tried to tear my leg off in 1993. I was off work 4.5 months. 3.5 hours surgery is a mess, okay? And then in 1994, my mother got cancer. She's recovered, thank God, but it was a mess. And then this year, I had other parts of my body that fell apart and had to be cut open and fixed. It was a mess. Never once was drinking an option. Never once was leaving God an option. A couple of times, I was a little aggravated at him, you know? It's all right with my higher power if I look up and I say, you know? Because he's at their, I'm his favorite sitcom, I believe that. I used to be a soap opera, and now I'm a sitcom. And he sits up there and giggles and knows I'll come around, you know. But through all of these things that happened to me, here's what the miracle was. When I was in the hospital for 5 days, there were meetings there every day. Because people brought them to me. People from AA came to my home and brought me food and newspapers and cleaned my house. They called me up, they held my hand. I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional. I'm coming up on a birthday. You know you get weird around a birthday. It's a big one, too. Thursday, I'll have 15 years of continued sobriety. They held my hand. They loved me. They gave me a hard time, and that's what I needed. When they could see I was getting too serious about all of this, they started making really snide jokes about parts of my body that we're not going to talk about. They were there for me. My group was there for me. The love of Alcoholics Anonymous was there for me. Okay? This is a woman who's unlovable. No one likes me. No one loves me. No one ever will. My life was a dark, pitiful, ugly hole. And now, here I am. I'm a boss in a casino, which is hysterical. I'm the one that will cut you off if you drink too much, which I just love. I'm the one you see on TV, you know. It's a great job. I get paid this just huge shitload of money for, like, nothing. I talk to people, that's it. It's great. It's great. And I have a wonderful, loving relationship with my husband. My parents think I'm great. They come out to visit every year and stay for a week. They wouldn't even talk to me when I got here. My sister, who called me a pig and said she never wanted to see me again, asked me to be the godmother to her child. I stood up at her wedding. She stood up at mine. The miracles that have happened to me since I walked in this door, just, I mean, there's more than I could possibly ever say in a day, much less an hour. Everything I did was wrong when I first got here. The one thing I did right was I kept coming back. They told me from day one, keep coming back. Fuck you. Keep coming back. Fuck you. Keep coming back. Okay. That's the story of my sobriety right there. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. And then I started to think it's even better if you don't leave. And I was told years ago that if you leave this room right now at 12:14, your miracle could be happening at 12:17, and you're going to miss it. It's right there in the chair next to you, or in the back of the room, or on the phone, or in a car, and you're going to miss it if you book now. So please, whatever you do, don't exit this room right before your miracle happens. Because you'll miss it. You'll miss it. And the way I feel today and the love that I have in my life today, I wouldn't want any of you to miss this. Please, whether or not you keep coming back is your business. I really, really hope that you don't leave. Thanks for having me.